Could be I exaggerated just a mite to make sure you took my point. They sent me down to see if a tree blew down across the stream. That happens from time to time. There's no need for anyone but me and you five to know it wasn't just that. We've got more important things to worry about in town these days than a little backed-up water. I'll say in my report that I located the blowdown, and some boys came along and helped me shift it out of the way of the water. Not that I'll mention ye by name. You'll not be getting any citations for dam-building in the barns. He surveyed the five of them. Ben was furiously wiping his eyes with his handkerchief. Bill was looking thoughtfully at the dam. Eddie was holding his aspirator in one hand. Stan stood close by Richie with one hand on Richie's arm, ready to squeeze hard if Richie should show the slightest sign of having anything to say other than thank you very much. You boys got no business at all in a dirty place like this, Mr. Nell went on. There's probably 60 different kinds of disease breeding down here. Breeding came out braiding, as in what a girl may do with her hair in the morning. Dumped down one way, streams full of piss and gray water, muck and slop, bugs and brambles, quick mud. You got no business at all in a dirty place like this. 4 clean city parks for you boyos to be playing ball in all day long, and I catch you down here. Jesus Christ. Well, but we like it down here, Bill said suddenly and defiantly. Well, when we come down here, nobody gives us any haddock.
What'd he say?
Mr. Nell asked Eddie. He said when we come down here, nobody gives us any static, Eddie said. His voice was thin and whistling, but it was also unmistakably firm. And he's right. When guys like us go to the park and say we want to play baseball, the other guys say, sure, you want to be second base or third. Richie cackled. Eddie gets off a good one, and you are there. Mr. Nell swung his head to look at him. Richie shrugged. Sorry, but he's right, and Bill's right, too. We like it down here. Richie thought Mr. Nell would become angry again at that, but the white-haired cop surprised him, surprised them all, with a smile.
Ah, yep, he said. I liked it down here meself as a boy. So I did. And I'll not forbid ye. But hark to what I'm telling you now.
He leveled a finger at them, and they all looked at him soberly.
If ye come down here to play, ye come in a gang like ye are now, together. Do ye understand me?
They nodded.
That means together all the time. No hide-and-seek games where you're split up one and one and one. You all know what's going on in this town. All the same, I don't forbid you to come down here, mostly because you'd be down here anyway. But for your own good, here or anywhere around, gang together.
He looked at Bill.
Do you disagree with me, young Master Bill Denbro?
No, sir, Bill said. We'll stay
That's good enough for me, Mr. Nell said. Your hand on it.
Bill stuck out his hand, and Mr. Nell shook it. Richie shook off Stan and stepped forward.
Sure and begorra, Mr. Nell, you're a prince among men, ye are. A foine man, a foine, foine man.
He stuck out his own hand, seized the Irishman's huge paw, and flagged it furiously, grinning all the time. To the bemused Mr. Nell, the boy looked like a hideous parody of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Thank you, boy, Mr. Nell said, retrieving his hand. You want to work on that a bit. As of now, ye sound about as Irish as Groucho Marx.
The other boys laughed, mostly in relief. Even as he was laughing, Stan shot Richie a reproachful look.
Grow up, Richie.
Mr. Nell shook hands all around, gripping Ben's last of all.
You've nothing to be ashamed of but bad judgment, big boy. As for that there, did you see how to do it in a book?
Ben shook his head.
Just figured it out?
Yes, sir.
Well, if that don't beat Harry, you'll do great things someday, I've no doubt, but the Barrens isn't the place to do 'em.
He looked around thoughtfully.
No great thing will ever be done here. Nasty place.
He sighed.
Tear it down, dear boys. Tear it right down. I believe I'll just sit me down in the shade of this bush here and bide a wee as you do it.
He looked ironically at Richie as he said this last, as if inviting another manic outburst.
Yes, sir,
Richie said humbly, and that was all. Mr. Nell nodded, satisfied, and the boys fell to work, once again turning to Ben, this time to show them the quickest way to tear down what he had shown them how to build. Meanwhile, Mr. Nell removed a brown bottle from inside his tunic and helped himself to a large gulp. He coughed, then blew out breath in an explosive sigh and regarded the boys with watery, benign eyes. "And what might ye have in your bottle, sor?" Richie asked from the place where he was standing knee-deep in the water.
"Richie, can't you ever shut up?" Eddie hissed.
"This?" Mr. Nell regarded Richie with mild surprise and looked at the bottle again. It had no label of any kind on it.
"This is the cough medicine of the gods, my boy. Now let's see if you can bend your back anywhere near as fast as you can wag your tongue."
3. Bill and Richie were walking up Witcham Street together later on. Bill was pushing Silver. After first building and then tearing down the dam, he simply did not have the energy it would have taken to get Silver up to cruising speed. Both boys were dirty, disheveled, and pretty well used up. Stan had asked them if they wanted to come over to his house and play Monopoly or Parcheesi or something, but none of them wanted to. It was getting late. Ben, sounding tired and depressed, said he wanted to go home and see if anybody had returned his library books. He had some hope of this, since the dairy library insisted on writing in the borrower's street address as well as his name on each book's pocket card. Eddie said he was going to watch the rock show on TV because Neil Sedaka was going to be on, and he wanted to see if Neil Sedaka was a Negro. Stan told Eddie not to be so stupid. Neil Sedaka was white. You could tell he was white just listening to him. Eddie claimed you couldn't tell anything by listening to them. Until last year, he had been positive Chuck Berry was white. But when he was on Bandstand, he turned out to be a Negro.
"My mother still thinks he's white, so that's one good thing," Eddie said. "If she finds out he's a Negro, she probably won't let me listen to his songs anymore."
Stan bet Eddie 4 funny books that Neil Sedaka was white, and the two of them set off together for Eddie's house to settle the issue. And here were Bill and Richie, headed in a direction which would bring them to Bill's house after a while, neither of them talking much. Richie found himself thinking about Bill's story of the picture that had turned its head and winked. And in spite of his tiredness, an idea came to him. It was crazy, but it also held a certain attraction.
"Billy, me boy," he said, "let's stop for a while. Take 5. I'm dead."
"No such little luck," Bill said, but he stopped, laid Silver carefully down on the edge of the green theological seminary lawn, and the two boys sat on the wide stone steps which led up to the rambling red Victorian structure.
"What a day," Bill said glumly.
There were dark purplish patches under his eyes. His face looked white and used.
"You better call your house when will we get to mine, so your folks don't go bananas."
"Yeah, you bet. Listen, Bill." Richie paused for a moment, thinking about Ben's mummy, Eddie's leper, and whatever Stan had almost told them. For a moment, something swam in his own mind, something about that Paul Bunyan statue out by City Center. But that had only been a dream, for God's sake. He pushed away such irrelevant thoughts and plunged.
"Let's go up to your house. What do you say? Take a look in Georgie's room. I want to see that picture."
Bill looked at Richie, shocked. He tried to speak, but could not. His stress was simply too great. He settled for shaking his head violently. Richie said,
"You heard Eddie's story, and Ben's. Do you believe what they said?"
"I don't know. I think they must have seen something."
"Yeah, me too. All the kids that have been killed around here, I think all of them would have had stories to tell, too. The only difference between Ben and Eddie and those kids is that Ben and Eddie didn't get caught."
Bill raised his eyebrows, but showed no great surprise. Richie had supposed Bill would have taken it that far himself. He couldn't talk so good, but he was no dummy.
"So now dig on this a while, Big Bill," Richie said. "A guy could dress up in a clown suit and kill kids. I don't know why he'd want to, but nobody can tell why crazy people do things, right?"
Right.
It's not that much different than the Joker in a Batman funny book."
Just hearing his ideas out loud excited Richie. He wondered briefly if he was actually trying to prove something or just throwing up a smokescreen of words so he could see that room, that picture. In the end, it probably didn't matter. In the end, maybe just seeing Bill's eyes light up with their own excitement was enough.
But where does the picture fit in?
"What do you think, Billy?"
In a low voice, not looking at Richie, Bill said he didn't think it had anything to do with the murders.
"I think it was Georgie's ghost."
"A ghost in a picture?"
Bill nodded. Richie thought about it. The idea of ghosts gave his child's mind no trouble at all. He was sure there were such things.
His parents were Methodists, and Richie went to church every Sunday and to Thursday night Methodist youth fellowship meetings as well. He knew a great deal of the Bible already, and he knew the Bible believed in all sorts of weird stuff. According to the Bible, God himself was at least one-third ghost, and that was just the beginning. You could tell the Bible believed in demons because Jesus threw a bunch of them out of this guy. Real chuckalicious ones, too. When Jesus asked the guy who had them what his name was, the demons answered and told him to go join the Foreign Legion, or something like that. The Bible believed in witches, or else why would it say, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live"? Some of the stuff in the Bible was even better than the stuff in the horror comics. People getting boiled in oil or hanging themselves like Judas Iscariot. The story about how wicked King Ahaz fell off the tower and all the dogs came and licked up his blood. The mass baby murders that had accompanied the births of both Moses and Jesus Christ. Guys who came out of their graves or flew into the air. Soldiers who witched down walls. Prophets who saw the future and fought monsters. All of that was in the Bible, and every word of it was true. So said Reverend Craig, and so said Richie's folks, and so said Richie. He was perfectly willing to credit the possibility of Bill's explanation. It was the logic which troubled him. "But you said you were scared. Why would George's ghost want to scare you, Bill?" Bill put a hand to his mouth and wiped it. The hand was trembling slightly. "He's probably mad at me for getting him killed. It was my fault. I sent him out with the
He was incapable of getting the word out, so he rocked his hand in the air instead. Richie nodded to show he understood what Bill meant, but not to indicate agreement.
"I don't think so," he said. "If you stabbed him in the back or shot him, that would be different. Or even if you, like, gave him a loaded gun that belonged to your dad to play with and he shot himself with it. But it wasn't a gun. It was just a boat. You didn't want to hurt him. In fact," Richie raised one finger and waggled it at Bill in a lawyerly way, "you just wanted the kid to have a little fun, right?" Bill thought back, thought desperately hard. What Richie had just said had made him feel better about George's death for the first time in months. But there was a part of him which insisted, with quiet firmness, that he was not supposed to feel better. "Of course it was your fault," that part of him insisted. "Not entirely, maybe, but at least partly. If not, how come there's that cold place on the couch between your mother and father? If not, how come no one ever says anything at the supper table anymore? Now it's just knives and forks rattling until you can't take it anymore and ask if you can be excused, please." It was as if he were the ghost, a presence that spoke and moved but was not quite heard or seen, a thing vaguely sensed but still not accepted as real. He did not like the thought that he was to blame, but the only alternative he could think of to explain their behavior was much worse, that all the love and attention his parents had given him before had somehow been the result of George's presence, and with George gone there was nothing for him. And all of that had happened at random, for no reason at all. And if you put your ear to that door, you could hear the winds of madness blowing outside. So he went over what he had done and felt and said on the day Georgie had died, part of him hoping that what Richie had said was true, part of him hoping just as hard it was not. He hadn't been a saint of a big brother to George, that much was certain. They had fights, plenty of them. Surely there had been one that day. No, no fight. For one thing, Bill himself had still been feeling too punk to work up a really good quarrel with George. He had been sleeping, dreaming something, dreaming about some turtle. Funny little animal, he couldn't remember just what, and he had awakened to the sound of the diminishing rain outside and George muttering unhappily to himself in the dining room. He asked George what was wrong. George came in and said he was trying to make a paper boat from the directions of his best book of activities, but it kept coming out wrong. Bill told George to bring his book, and sitting next to Richie on the steps leading up to the seminary, he remembered how Georgie's eyes lit up when the paper boat came out right, and how good that look had made him feel, like Georgie thought he was a real hot shit, a straight shooter, the guy who could do it until it got done, making him feel, in short, like a big brother. The boat had killed George, but Richie was right. It hadn't been like handing George a loaded gun to play with. Bill hadn't known what was going to happen. No way he could. He drew a deep, shuddering breath, feeling something like a rock, something he hadn't even known was there, go rolling off his chest.
All at once he felt better about everything. He opened his mouth to tell Richie this and burst into tears instead. Alarmed, Richie put an arm around Bill's shoulders. After taking a quick glance around to make sure no one who might mistake them for a couple of fagolas was looking. "You're okay," he said. "You're okay, Billy, right? Come on, turn off the waterworks."
"I didn't want him to get killed," Bill sobbed.
"That wasn't on my mind at all." "Christ, Billy, I know it wasn't," Richie said. "If you'd wanted to scrub him, you would have pushed him downstairs or something." Richie patted Bill's shoulder clumsily and gave him a hard little hug before letting go. "Come on, quit bawling, okay? You sound like a baby." Little by little, Bill stopped. He still hurt, but this hurt seemed cleaner, as if he had cut himself open and taken out something that was rotting inside him. And that feeling of relief was still there.
"I didn't want him to get killed," Bill repeated. "And if you to tell anybody I was crying, I'll bust your nose."
"I won't tell," Richie said. "Don't worry. He was your brother, for gosh sake. If my brother got killed, I'd cry my fucking head off."
You don't have a brother."
"Yeah, but if I did,
you would?"
"Course." Richie paused, fixing Bill with a wary eye, trying to decide if Bill was really over it. He was still wiping his red eyes with his snot rag, but Richie decided he probably was. "All I meant was that I don't know why George would want to haunt you. So maybe the picture's got something to do with, well, with that other, the clown."
"Maybe George doesn't know. Maybe he thinks."
Richie understood what Bill was trying to say and waved it aside. "After you croak, you know everything people ever thought about you, Big Bill." He spoke with the indulgent air of a great teacher correcting a country bumpkin's fatuous ideas. "It's in the Bible. It says, 'Yea, even though we can't see too much in the mirror right now, we will see through it like it was a window after we die.' That's in 1 Thessalonians or 2 Babylonians, I forget which. It means..."
"I see what it means," Bill said.
"So what do you say?"
"Huh?"
"Let's go up to his room and take a look. Maybe we'll get a clue about who's killing all the kids."
"I'm scared to."
"I am too," Richie said, thinking it was just more sand, something to say that would get Bill moving. And then something heavy turned over in his midsection, and he discovered it was true. He was scared green. 4. The two boys slipped into the Denbro house like ghosts. Bill's father was still at work. Sharon Denbro was in the kitchen reading a paperback at the kitchen table. The smell of supper, codfish, drifted out into the front hall. Richie called home so his mom would know he wasn't dead, just at Bill's.
"Someone there?"
Mrs. Denbro called as Richie put the phone down. They froze, eyeing each other guiltily. Then Bill called,
"Mami, Mom, and
Richie Tozier, ma'am," Richie yelled.
"Hello, Richie,"
Mrs. Denbro called back, her voice disconnected, almost not there at all.
"Would you like to stay for supper?"
"Thanks, ma'am, but my mom's going to pick me up in half an hour or so."
"Tell her I said hello, won't you?"
"Yes, ma'am, I sure will."
"Come on," Bill whispered. "That's enough for small talk."
They went upstairs and down the hall to Bill's room. It was boy neat, which meant it would have given the mother of the boy in question only a mild headache to look at. The shelves were stuffed with a helter-skelter collection of books and comics. There were more comics, plus a few models and toys, and a stack of 45s on the desk. There was also an old Underwood office model typewriter on it. His folks had given it to him for Christmas 2 years ago, and Bill sometimes wrote stories on it. He did this a bit more frequently since George's death. The pretending seemed to ease his mind. There was a phonograph on the floor across from the bed with a pile of folded clothes stacked on the lid. Bill put the clothes in the drawers of his bureau and then took the records from the desk. He shuffled through them, picking half a dozen. He put them on the phonograph's fat spindle and turned the machine on. The Fleetwood started singing, "Come Softly, Darling." Richie held his nose. Bill grinned in spite of his thumping heart.
"They don't hike rock and roll," he said. "They gave me this one for my birthday. Also two Papat Baboon records and Tommy Sands. I keep Little Richard and
Skareman J.J. Hawkins for when they're not here. But if she hears the music, she'll think we're in my room. Come on.
George's room was across the hall. The door was shut. Richie looked at it and licked his lips.
They don't keep it locked?
He whispered to Bill. Suddenly, he found himself hoping it was locked. Suddenly, he was having trouble believing this had been his idea. Bill, his face pale, shook his head and turned the knob. He stepped in and looked back at Richie. After a moment, Richie followed. Bill shut the door behind them, muffling the Fleetwoods. Richie jumped a little at the soft snick of the latch. He looked around, fearful and intensely curious at the same time. The first thing he noticed was the dry mustiness of the air.
No one's opened a window in here for a long time, he thought. Heck, no one's breathed in here for a long time. That's really what it feels like.
He shuddered a little at the thought and licked his lips again. His eye fell on George's bed, and the thought of George sleeping now under a comforter of earth in Mount Hope Cemetery. Rotting there. His hands not folded because you needed two hands to do that old folding routine, and George had been buried with only one. A little sound escaped Richie's throat. Bill turned and looked at him inquiringly.
You're right, Richie said huskily. It's spooky in here. I don't see how you could stand to come in alone.
He was my brother, Bill said simply. Sometimes I want to, is all.
There were posters on the walls, little kid posters. One showed Tom Terrific, the cartoon character on Captain Kangaroo's program. Tom was springing over the head and clutching hands of Krabby Appleton, who was, of course, rotten to the core. Another showed Donald Duck's nephews, Huey, Louie, and Dewey, marching off into the wilderness in their junior woodchuck's coonskin caps. A third, which George had colored himself, showed Mr. Dew holding up traffic so a bunch of little kids headed for school could cross the street. Mr. Dew says, wait for the crossing guard, it said underneath.
Kid wasn't too cool about staying in the lines, Richie thought, and then shuddered. The kid was never going to get any better at it either.
Richie looked at the table by the window. Mrs. Denbro had stood up all of George's rank cards there, half open. Looking at them, knowing there would never be more, knowing that George had died before he could stay in the lines when he colored, knowing his life had ended irrevocably and eternally with only those few kindergarten and first grade rank cards, all the idiot truth of death crashed home to Richie for the first time. It was as if a large iron safe had fallen into his brain and buried itself there.
I could die, his mind screamed at him suddenly in tones of betrayed horror. Anybody could. Anybody could.
Boy, oh boy, he said in a shaky voice. He could manage no more.
Yeah,
Bill said in a near whisper. He sat down in George's bed.
Look.
Richie followed Bill's pointing finger and saw the photo album lying closed on the floor. My photographs, Richie read. George Elmer Denbro, age 6.
Age 6?
His mind shrieked in those same tones of shrill betrayal.
Age 6 forever. Anybody could. Shit. Fucking anybody.
It was open, Bill said. But before.
So it closed, Richie said uneasily.
He sat down on the bed beside Bill and looked at the photo album. Lots of books close on their own.
The pages, maybe, but not the cover.
It closed itself. He looked at Richie solemnly, his eyes very dark in his pale, tired face.
But it wants you to open it up again. That's what I think.
Richie got up and walked slowly over to the photograph album. It lay at the base of a window screened with light curtains. Looking out, he could see the apple tree in the Denbro backyard. A swing rocked slowly back and forth from one gnarled black limb. He looked down at George's book again. A dried maroon stain colored the thickness of the pages in the middle of the book. It could have been old ketchup. Sure, it was easy enough to see George looking at his photo album while eating a hot dog or a big sloppy hamburger. He takes a big bite and some ketchup squirts out onto the book. Little kids were always doing spasmoid stuff like that. It could be ketchup. But Richie knew it was not. He touched the album briefly and then drew his hand away. It felt cold. It had been lying in a place where the strong summer sunlight, only slightly filtered by those light curtains, would have been falling on it all day. But it felt cold.
Well, I'll just leave it alone, Richie thought. I don't want to look in his stupid old album anyway, see a lot of people I don't know. I think maybe I'll tell Bill I changed my mind, and we can go to his room and read comic books for a while, and then I'll go home and eat supper and go to bed early because I'm pretty tired. And when I wake up tomorrow morning, I'm sure I'll be sure that stuff was just ketchup. That's what I'll do. Yowza.
So he opened the album with hands that seemed 1,000 miles away from him, at the end of long plastic arms, and he looked at the faces and places in George's album, the aunts, the uncles, the babies, the houses, the old Fords and Studebakers, the telephone lines, the mailboxes, the picket fences, the wheel ruts with muddy water in them, the Ferris wheel at the Estee County Fair, the standpipe, the ruins of the Kitchener Ironworks. His fingers flipped faster and faster, and suddenly the pages were blank. He turned back, not wanting to, but unable to help himself. Here was a picture of downtown Derry, Main Street and Canal Street from around 1930, and beyond it there was nothing.
There's no school picture of George in here, Richie said.
He looked at Bill with a mixture of relief and exasperation.
What kind of line were you handing me, Big Bill?
What?
This picture of downtown in the olden days is the last one in the book. All the rest of the pages are blank.
Bill got off the bed and joined Richie. He looked at the picture of downtown Derry as it had been almost 30 years ago. Old-fashioned cars and trucks, old-fashioned street lights with clusters of globes like big white grapes, pedestrians by the canal caught in mid-stride by the click of a shutter. He turned the page and, just as Richie had said, there was nothing.
No, wait. Not quite nothing.
There was one studio corner, the sort of item you use to mount photographs.
It was here, he said, and tapped the studio corner. Look.
Jeepers, what do you think happened to it?
I don't know.
Bill had taken the album from Richie and was now holding it on his own lap. He turned back through the pages, looking for George's picture. He gave up after a minute, but the pages did not. They turned themselves, flipping slowly but steadily with big, deliberate riffling sounds. Bill and Richie looked at each other wide-eyed and then back down. It arrived at that last picture again, and the pages stopped turning. Here was downtown Derry in sepia tones, the city as it had been long before either Bill or Richie had been born.
Say,
Richie said suddenly and took the album back from Bill. There was no fear in his voice now, and his face was suddenly full of wonder.
Holy shit!
What?
What is it?
Us.
That's what it is. Holy Jeezly Crow, look!
Bill took one side of the book, bent over it, sharing it. They looked like boys at choir practice. Bill drew in breath sharply, and Richie knew he had seen it, too. Caught under the shiny surface of this old black-and-white photograph, two small boys were walking along Main Street toward the point where Main and Center intersected, the point where the canal went underground for 1.5 miles or so. The two boys showed up clearly against the low concrete wall at the edge of the canal. One was wearing knickers. The other was wearing something that looked almost like a sailor suit. A tweed cap was perched on his head. They were turned in three-quarter profile toward the camera, looking at something on the far side of the street. The boy in the knickers was Richie Tozier, beyond a doubt, and the boy in the sailor suit and the tweed cap was Stuttering Bill. They stared at themselves in a picture, almost 3 times as old as they were, hypnotized. The inside of Richie's mouth suddenly felt as dry as dust and as smooth as glass. A few steps ahead of the boys in the picture, there was a man holding the brim of his fedora, his top coat frozen forever as it flapped out behind him in a sudden gust of wind. There were Model Ts on the street, a Pierce Arrow, Chevrolets with running boards.
I don't believe,
Bill began, and that was when the picture began to move. The Model T that should have remained eternally in the middle of the intersection, or at least until the chemicals in the old photo finally dissolved completely, passed through it, a haze of exhaust puffing out of its tailpipe. It went on toward Up Mile Hill. A small white hand shot out of the driver's side window and signaled a left turn. It swung onto Court Street and passed beyond the photo's white border and so out of sight. The Pierce Arrow, the Chevrolets, the Packards, they all began to roll along, dodging their separate ways through the intersection. After 28 years or so, the skirt of the man's topcoat finally finished its flap. He settled his hat more firmly on his head and walked on. The two boys completed their turn, coming full face, and a moment later Richie saw what they had been looking at as a mangy dog came trotting across Center Street. The boy in the sailor suit, Bill, raised 2 fingers to the corners of his mouth and whistled. Stunned beyond any ability to move or think, Richie realized he could hear the whistle, could hear the car's irregular sewing machine engines. The sounds were faint, like sounds heard through thick glass, but they were there. The dog glanced toward the two boys, then trotted on. The boys glanced at each other and laughed like chipmunks. They started to walk on, and then the Richie in knickers grabbed Bill's arm and pointed toward the canal. They turned in that direction.
No,
Richie thought. Don't do that, don't. They went to the low concrete wall, and suddenly the clown popped up over its edge like a horrible jack-in-the-box. A clown with Georgie Denbrough's face, his hair slicked back, his mouth a hideous grin full of bleeding grease paint, his eyes black holes. One hand clutched three balloons on a string. With the other, he reached for the boy in the sailor suit and seized his neck.
No,
Bill cried and reached for the picture. Reached into the picture.
Stop it, Bill,
Richie shouted and grabbed for him. He was almost too late. He saw the tips of Bill's fingers go through the surface of the photograph and into that other world. He saw the fingertips go from the warm pink of living flesh to the mummified cream color that passed for white in old photos. At the same time, they became small and disconnected. It was like the peculiar optical illusion one sees when one thrusts a hand into a glass bowl of water. The part of the hand underwater seems to be floating, disembodied, inches away from the part which is still out of the water. A series of diagonal cuts slashed across Bill's fingers at the point where they ceased being his fingers and became photo fingers. It was as if he had stuck his hand into the blades of a fan instead of into a picture. Richie seized his forearm and gave a tremendous yank. They both fell over. George's album hit the floor and snapped itself shut with a dry clap. Bill stuck his fingers in his mouth. Tears of pain stood in his eyes. Richie could see blood running down his palm to his wrist in thin streams.
Let me see, he said. Hurts, Bill said.
He held his hand out to Richie, palm down. There were ladder-like slash cuts running up his index, second, and third fingers. The pinky had barely touched the surface of the photograph, if it had a surface. And although that finger had not been cut, Bill told Richie later that the nail had been neatly clipped, as if with a pair of manicurist scissors.
Jesus, Bill,
Richie said. Band-aids. That was all he could think of. God, they had been lucky. If he hadn't pulled Bill's arm when he did, his fingers might have been amputated instead of just badly cut.
We got to fix those up. Your mother can... Never mind my mother,
Bill said. He grabbed the photo album again, spilling drops of blood on the floor.
Don't open that again, Richie cried, grabbing frantically at Bill's shoulder. Jesus Christ, Billy, you almost lost your fingers.
Bill shook him off. He flipped through the pages, and there was a grim determination on his face that scared Richie more than anything else. Bill's eyes looked almost mad. His wounded fingers printed George's album with new blood. It didn't look like ketchup yet, but when it had a little time to dry, it would. Of course it would. And here was the downtown scene again. The Model T stood in the middle of the intersection. The other cars were frozen in the places where they had been before. The man walking toward the intersection held the brim of his fedora, his coat once more belled out in mid-flap. The two boys were gone. There were no boys in the picture anywhere, but...
Look,
Richie whispered and pointed. He was careful to keep the tip of his finger well away from the picture. An arc showed just over the low concrete wall at the edge of the canal, the top of something round. Something like a balloon. 5. They got out of George's room just in time. Bill's mother was a voice at the foot of the stairs and a shadow on the wall.
Have you boys been wrestling? She asked sharply. I heard a thud.
Just a little, my mom.
Bill threw a sharp glance at Richie. Be quiet, it said.
Well, I want you to stop it. I thought the ceiling was going to come right down on my head.
Well, we will.
They heard her go back toward the front of the house. Bill had wrapped his handkerchief around his bleeding hand. It was turning red and in a moment would start to drip. The boys went down to the bathroom, where Bill held his hand under the faucet until the bleeding stopped. Cleaned, the cuts looked thin but cruelly deep. Looking at their white lips and the red meat just inside them made Richie feel sick to his stomach. He wrapped them with band-aids as fast as he could.
Hurts like hell, Bill said.
Well, why'd you want to go and put your hand in there, you wet end?
Bill looked solemnly at the rings of band-aids on his fingers, then up at Richie.
It was the clown, he said. It was the clown pretending to be Judge George.
That's right, Richie said. Like it was the clown pretending to be the mummy when Ben saw it. Like it was the clown pretending to be that sick bum Eddie saw.
The leper.
Right.
But is it really a clown?
It's a monster, Richie said flatly. Some kind of monster. Some kind of monster right here in Derry. And it's killing kids.
6. On a Saturday, not long after the incident of the dam and the barrens, Mr. Nell and the picture that moved, Richie, Ben, and Beverly Marsh, came face to face with not one monster but two. And they paid to do it. Richie did, anyway. These monsters were scary, but not really dangerous. They stalked their victims on the screen of the Aladdin Theater while Richie, Ben, and Bev watched from the balcony. One of the monsters was a werewolf, played by Michael Landon, and he was cool because even when he was the werewolf, he still had sort of a duck's ass haircut. The other was this smashed-up hot rodder, played by Gary Conway. He was brought back to life by a descendant of Victor Frankenstein, who fed all parts he didn't need to a bunch of alligators he kept in the basement. Also on the program, a movie-tone newsreel that showed the latest Paris fashions and the latest Vanguard rocket explosions at Cape Canaveral, two Warner Brothers cartoons, one Popeye cartoon, and a Chilly Willy cartoon. For some reason, the hat Chilly Willy wore always cracked Richie up. And previews of coming attractions. The coming attractions included two pictures Richie immediately put on his Gotta See list. I Married a Monster from Outer Space and The Blob. Ben was very quiet during the show. Old Haystack had nearly been spotted by Henry, Belch, and Victor earlier, and Richie assumed that was all that was troubling him. Ben, however, had forgotten all about the creeps. They were sitting close to the screen down below, chucking popcorn boxes at each other and hooting. Beverly was the reason for his silence. Her nearness was so overwhelming that he was almost ill with it. His body would break out in goosebumps, and then, if she would so much as shift in her seat, his skin would flash hot, as if with a tropical fever. When her hand brushed his, reaching for the popcorn, he trembled with exultation. He thought later that those 3 hours in the dark next to Beverly had been both the longest and shortest hours of his life. Richie, unaware that Ben was in deep throes of calf love, was feeling just as fine as paint. In his book, the only thing any better than a couple of Francis the Talking Mule pictures was a couple of horror pictures in a theater filled with kids, all of them yelling and screaming at the gory parts. He certainly did not connect any of the goings-ons in the two low-budget American International Pictures they were watching with what was going on in town. Not then, at least. He had seen the Twin Shock Show Saturday matinee ad in the news on Friday morning and had almost immediately forgotten how badly he had slept the night before and how he had finally gotten up and turned on the light in his closet, a real baby trick for sure, but he hadn't been able to get a wink of sleep until he'd done it. But by the following morning, things had seemed normal again. Well, almost. He began to think that maybe he and Bill had just shared a hallucination. Of course, the cuts on Bill's fingers weren't a hallucination, but maybe they'd just been paper cuts from some of the sheets in Georgie's album. Pretty thick paper. Could have been. Maybe. Besides, there was no law saying he had to spend the next 10 years thinking about it, was there? Nope. And so, following an experience that might well have sent an adult running for the nearest head shrinker, Richie Tozier got up, ate a giant pancake breakfast, saw the ad for the two horror movies on the amusements page of the paper, checked his funds, found them a little low, well, non-existent might actually have been a better word, and began to pester his father for chores. His dad, who had come to the table already wearing his white dentist tunic, put down the sports pages and poured himself a second cup of coffee. He was a pleasant-looking man with a rather thin face. He wore steel-rimmed spectacles, was developing a bald spot at the back of his head, and would die of cancer of the larynx in 1973. He looked at the ad to which Richie was pointing.
"Horror movies," Wentworth Tozier said.
"Yeah," Richie said, grinning.
"Feel like you have to go," Wentworth Tozier said.
"Yeah."
"Feel like you'll probably die in convulsions of disappointment if you don't get to see those two trashy movies."
"Yeah, yeah, I would. I know I would."
"Greg!"
Richie fell out of his chair onto the floor, clutching his throat, his tongue sticking out. This was Richie's admittedly peculiar way of turning on the charm.
"Oh, God, Richie, will you please stop it?"
his mother asked him from the stove where she was frying him a couple of eggs to top off the pancakes.
"Gee, Rich," his father said as Richie got back into his chair, "I guess I must have forgotten to pay you your allowance on Monday. That's the only reason I can think of for you needing more money on Friday."
"Well, gone?"
Well, that's an extremely deep subject for a boy with such a shallow mind, Wentworth Tozier said. He put his elbow on the table and then cupped his chin on the palm of his hand, regarding his only son with what appeared to be deep fascination. Where'd it go? Richie immediately fell into the voice of Toodles the English butler.
Why, I spent it, didn't I, Governor? Pip-pip, cheerio, and all that rot. My part of the war effort. All got to do our bit to beat back the bloody Hun, don't we? Bit of a sticky wicket, eh, what? Bit of a wet hedgehog, what? Bit of a
pile of bullshit, Went said amiably and reached for the strawberry preserves. Spare me the vulgarity at the breakfast table, if you please, Maggie Tozier said to her husband as she brought Richie's eggs over to the table. And to Richie, I don't know why you want to fill your head up with such awful junk anyway.
Oh, Mom, Richie said. He was outwardly crushed, inwardly jubilant. He could read both of his parents like books, well-worn and well-loved books, and he was pretty sure he was going to get what he wanted, chores and permission to go to the show Saturday afternoon. Went leaned forward toward Richie and smiled widely.
I think I have you right where I want you, he said.
Is that right, Dad? Richie said and smiled back, a trifle uneasily.
Oh, yes. You know our lawn, Richie? You are familiar with our lawn?
Indeed I am, Governor, Richie said, becoming Toodles again, or trying to.
Bit shaggy, eh, what?
What? Went said. And you, Richie, will remedy that condition.
I will?
You will. Mow it, Richie.
Okay, Dad, sure,
Richie said, but a terrible suspicion had suddenly blossomed in his mind. Maybe his dad didn't mean just the front lawn. Wentworth Tozier's smile widened to a predatory shark's grin.
All of it, O idiot child of my loins. Front, back, sides. And when you finish, I will cross your palm with two green pieces of paper with the likeness of George Washington on one side and a picture of a pyramid or topped with the ever-watching oculary on the other.
I don't get you, Dad, Richie said, but he was afraid he did.
$2.
$2 for the whole lawn? Richie cried, genuinely wounded. It's the biggest lawn on the block. Geez, Dad. Went sighed and picked the paper up again. Richie could read the front page headline, Missing Boy Prompts New Fears. He thought briefly of George Denbrough's strange scrapbook. But that had surely been a hallucination. And even if it hadn't been, that was yesterday and this was today.
Guess you didn't want to see those movies as bad as you thought, Went said from behind the paper.
A moment later, his eyes appeared over the top, studying Richie. Studying him a trifle smugly, in truth. Studying him the way a man with four of a kind studies his poker opponent over the fan of his cards.
When the Clark twins do it all, you give them $2 each.
That's true, Went admitted. But as far as I know, they don't want to go to the movies tomorrow. Or if they do, they must have funds sufficient to the occasion because they haven't popped by to check the state of our herbiage around our domicile lately. You, on the other hand, do want to go and find yourself lacking the funds to do so. That pressure you feel in your midsection may be the 5 pancakes and 2 eggs you ate for breakfast, Richie, or it may just be the barrel I have you over. What?
Went's eyes submerged behind the paper again.
He's blackmailing me, Richie said to his mother, who was eating dry toast. She was trying to lose weight again. This is blackmail. I just hope you know that.
Yes, dear, I know that, his mother said. There's egg on your chin.
End of side 9.